think there's any end-of-life plan for all of those Iridium satellites and all of those global positioning satellites, for instance. Over to you for comments on this poll. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, everything that's in geosynchronous orbit will stay there. They'll actually push it further out into their, what they call the graveyard. So I'm not too worried about them. The ones that'll, well, your GPS satellites there at 11,000 miles up, not 23,000, roughly half the distance. Maybe someday they'll come back. There's a lot of them. There's got to be, what, 25 at least. And then European Space Agency, they're going to put up their own version of our GPS system called Galileo, and they're in the process of doing that now. And they'll wind up with as many satellites, and probably at the same altitude. But 11,000, that's still pretty high. It's going to be a long time before they come back. Space Station, yeah, roughly 1 million pounds. Remember when the Mir space station came back? They just let that thing break up over the Pacific Ocean. There's pictures of that coming back. Not much survived getting, you know, down to the water. They just ran a test with the ATV. Yeah, that's the spacecraft, that cargo craft that went up to the space station. That's the fifth one by the European Space Agency. That just disembarked from the station a couple weeks ago. And they burnt that up over the South Pacific. They had plans on bringing that in on a more shallow trajectory. They wanted to do that a couple of weeks from now, but they had some problems with electrical systems, and they just chose to deorbit in the same fashion that the other ones have been at a steeper incline. But they wanted to bring it down at a shallow incline and take pictures of it. Well, they had all kinds of cameras, aircraft, and they were going to photograph this, and equipment inside the ATV that was going to transmit data back to European Space Agency, and they were going to evaluate the numbers, temperatures, on this shallow deorbit, and this way they would try to make it worked out the way they thought. They would eventually plan on doing the same to the International Space Station. But we're good until 2024. That's what the space station is good right now. I mean, mechanically it'll go beyond that, but it's being paid up to. The money stops after that unless a new president gets in there and allows it to go further. They probably will. Back to you, Dick.
Good question for Paul.
You got it, John.
Paul, on that piece of paint that struck the windscreen, was it embedded in the screen? If not, what were the forensics that determined it was paint? And there was an Israeli paint. How did they do that? If you know, KC2WGB.
No, NASA evaluated it, and that's what they came up with. I suspect that there must have been some kind of something left behind, and then they must have evaluated it to figure out that it came from that spacecraft. I have an old book here from the 80s that shows that. I actually have a picture of the glass on the space shuttle. So, I don't remember reading anything, you know, how they actually figured it out. I guess I could research that, but my guess is they probably did some kind of testing on that, on a fragment that might have been left behind, John.
Okay, Paul, very good. Dick, back to you, sir.
Question for Paul.
You got it, Tony.
Yeah, Paul, all these rocket ships that are taking off of Israel, the United States, Russia, is there, like when a plane takes off from Kennedy Airport, you know, there's a time schedule for each flight, you know? Is there a synchronization, a place that they're going to check in with a special program before they, you know, shoot a rocket off into space so it doesn't interfere with some other country shooting off a rocket? Is there some kind of a synchronization involved there? KC2UJL.
got some kind of an attack going on. Although I think there's less of a chance of that nowadays than there were during the Cold War days. For instance, there's a website, spaceflight.com. That's the website you go to. And there's a list of every single rocket plan for the next 11 months all the way till the end of 2015. And then there's got to be about 58 launches planned. And everyone is dated. Everyone is timed. They give you the time, what they're launching. They'll let you know to be decided. You'll see TB, D written down. That means to be decided. That means they haven't figured out exactly when it's going to go up, but when it is, they'll list it. All the countries are well aware of all the other countries' launch times and what they're putting up in the air. Tony, back to you.
I see you've got European Space Agency, which I presume includes the United Kingdom, France, Germany. They do quite a few launches by way of South America. Is it called Kourou? I think it's the name of the launch facility. Soviet Union's got their launch facility. Japan's got their launch facility. I don't know if Australia's got one. The United States has at least two, West Coast, East Coast, and again, what was that again, Paul?
Yeah, a lot more than that. You know, Wallops Island is shut down for now until March 1st of 2016 next year. That's when Wallops Island is going to be used again for another orbital launch. But, you know, of course we got Florida and Vandenberg, California, but you've also got a launch facility in Hawaii. They're going to be launching some rockets, small rockets into orbit a couple of months from now from there. You've got another one in Alaska. Orbital Science launches rockets out of Alaska. We got them all over. And there was Russia, too, has four launch facilities. China has three. India has one. And there's Sea Launch. That thing goes, they put it right on the equator, and it's a floating thing that they launch rockets off of that. Japan has, I think they just got the one launch facility. But, they're all over the globe. Australia? No, I never heard of Australia launching one, Dick.
A lot of launches. Now, has the launch facility in Hawaii ever launched anything that went into orbit? Or is that something that's coming in the near future, Paul?
Yeah, it's called the Strife launches. Small, maybe 100 kilogram launches that they're going to put up. I could look it up for you, but I know they have a launch coming up this year. They probably do at least once a year.
So Hawaii has been putting things into orbit for what length of time, Paul?
I think they've been doing it probably at least 3 or 4 years now. We have a lot. I'm trying to think of the island's name. I'll have to look it up. But yeah, it's in Hawaii. Something missile launch range. I'll look the name up. Just like I can't remember the one up in Alaska, Kodiak.
Yeah, I can see that we should have been using Hawaii a long time ago. The good news of Hawaii is that it's essentially circled by water everywhere. So you're not restricted into what direction. You can do a polar launch, an equatorial launch. You can do almost anything from Hawaii. Launch in any direction you want. Yeah, you got to worry a little bit about the fact that if you're doing just right, you can drop something on the nearest adjacent island in the Hawaii chain. But still, there's probably ways around that. Then again, you really want to make the majority of your launches from west to east, because at the equator, the Earth is traveling something like 1,000 miles an hour. The first 1,000 miles an hour of velocity, you put something in space, you get it free of charge because of Earth rotation. And it takes you a lot of extra fuel to go the other way. So, other than the fact that the Israelis, the only place they had water is the Mediterranean, which is dead west of them, they had to make a launch to the west. Therefore, they needed a much more potent rocket to overcome the first 1,000 miles an hour of the Earth rotation, and then beyond that, do your launching. That's a lot more boosting required. Over to you for any comments on this, Paul. K2LAW.
Okay, as I'm listening to you, I'm trying to find that that Hawaii launch. But no, I don't have any other comments, Dick. But I had actually one question about that traveling wave tube. We always talked about the power output. I'm wondering if there's a way by sending a signal up to it, are we able to figure out what the power is coming back? You know, I mean, I've heard from Ed Stone, been in charge of that Voyager forever, talking about 24 watts, and that was about a year or so ago. And I'm just wondering, you know, I mean, you know, is there any other way to do it outside of, you know, taking an amperage and voltage reading and sending, you know, telemetry back from Voyager saying, okay, I'm taking a reading on my spacecraft, and I know that my transmitter is now doing 23 watts. Outside of that, is there another way to do it from our end back to there?
With rare exception, Paul, whenever you put a traveling wave tube in service, you put directional couplers on the output for sure, and maybe even on the input. Those directional couplers are a passive device with a diode detector, and the voltage out of the diode tells you how many watts is coming out of the tube. And quite often it's a dual directional coupler, one looking forward and one looking back. If the tube is being fired into an antenna that just became a short circuit, you're going to get a lot of reflected power. And so the reflected power sensing directional coupler will give you a warning to turn down the tube before you do damage. So the directional couplers that are sampling power going out, that's the easiest way to know what the real power is. There's no easy way of measuring voltage, current, and whatever on the tube. That beam, you're continuously supplying the voltage and current to establish that beam. And that beam is a very specific amount of electrons because it is focused that way. If you did something to increase or decrease the amplitude of the beam, you would be changing the focus characteristics. And as such, if it's not well focused, some of the beam starts hitting the helix. And when you get helix interception, you can burn hot spots in the helix and burn it out. That's one of the main failure modes of a tube. Let me drop. The biggest protection circuit on any traveling wave tube power supply senses helix current. On the average traveling wave tube of the size we're talking about, if the helix current goes above 10 or 15 milliamps, then you know that 3/4 of an ampere beam, 10 milliamps of it, at extremely high velocity, half the speed of light, so to speak, those electrons are hitting your helix, probably in one spot, and they're about to burn it up. So you sample helix current all the time, and you immediately put the tube in a standby mode if you exceed that number until you find out what's going on. That's the built-in self-protect. So the beam is constant in current, constant in voltage, so therefore measuring the power into the tube doesn't tell you anything. Doesn't even tell you if the tube is really got any signal going through it, if you know what I mean. So you've got to directly measure the signal coming out with directional couplers. Does that make some sense, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I got it. Very good, Dick. I don't know what it started off as. I thought it was a 30-watt system or something. It's down to 23 watts. I don't know what it really started out as. Oh, by the way, the Super Stripe, like I said, STRYPI, that's the launch from Hawaii. It's called the Pacific Missile Range Facility. I knew it was the barking stance is the official location in Kauai, Hawaii. The Super Stripe launch vehicle is going to deliver a Hiya-K satellite spacecraft with multiple CubeSat payloads into orbit. So it's a rocket developed by the Sandia National Laboratories, also with the University of Hawaii, and they're involved with the U.S. Defense Department as well. But this thing's been delayed a while. It was supposed to go up a couple of years ago, and then for whatever reason it was canceled. And now they're going to be putting this up, actually, in about a week or two. Looks like March 5th or something like that. Back to you, Dick.
Breaker Channel, log me a CB radio.
Now, one of the things that I should know and I don't know, Paul, is Hawaii closer to the equator than Cape Canaveral? The closer you are to the equator, the more desirable it is a launch location. I wonder if Hawaii is south of Florida. Over to you, Paul.
That's about even. I think maybe just a little further south of Florida. You know, probably the equivalent of the Cuban area.
Okay, the European Space Agency, their main launch facility is in Kourou, British Guiana, I think it is. They're south of the equator. Are they more south of the equator than Florida is north of the equator? Do you happen to know, Paul? Go ahead.
I think they're up only a couple of 3 or 4 or 5 degrees off the equator. They're close. French Guiana is the country. So, the northern slopes of French Guiana, Kourou, French Guiana. And they got a great location. They could actually put up a heavier payload for the same amount of thrust than we can. Florida is roughly, 23 degrees, I think, off the equator. So they, you know, they have a little advantage. Closer you are to the equator, the better off you are.
Yep, they get that extra miles per hour advantage. If you're at the equator, you're moving something like 1,000 miles an hour as the Earth rotates. Whereas if you're at the North Pole, your velocity is zero compared to the center of the Earth. You ain't going to put a satellite launch facility there. And one of the puzzle questions I've sometimes asked people in the past is that assume now you want to be able to look at your satellites that are in geosynchronous orbit. Geosynchronous orbit means that the satellite is directly over the equator, 23,300 miles up. And now you're going to choose a ground station location on planet Earth. Assume now you've got a synchronous orbit satellite every 1 degree along the equator. You've got 360 satellites up there, every 1 degree in longitude. And you're going to choose a place on the Earth for your ground station that can see the maximum number of those satellites. Where would you locate that space, that ground station, Paul? It's a tough one. WS2N, K2RIW.
IDY with a comment.
Go ahead, Hank.
Yeah, I just looked it up when we were talking. You don't know what you were talking, and it looks like Kennedy Space Center is around 29 degrees north latitude, and Hawaii is 21 and a half north. So I'm not quite sure what the big advantage of difference would be, but it does seem to be at least 6 degrees.
Okay, 6 or 8 degrees closer to the equator, it's the advantage. You pick up more speed, and particularly if you're launching something in geosynchronous orbit, where it's going to be directly over the equator. As you're further away from the equator in your launch, after you get the satellite up in the air, you have to make you have to turn the corner, if you know what I mean. You go down toward the equator and then you turn the corner. Well, that takes rocket power to do that. So the closer you are to the equator, the more efficient the launch is for a geosynchronous satellite. I'll be also asking you that question, Hank, but Paul first. The world's best WS2N ground station. Where on Earth would you locate it so that it'd see the greatest number of satellites that are in orbit directly over the equator, and there's one satellite every 1 degree, so there's 360 satellites. Where would you choose to put your ground station, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Ideally, I'd like to link all my satellites together and send them to one big satellite right over the middle of the country and you wouldn't even have to move your antennas. You have a whole setup in White Sands, New Mexico. And, that would be ideal. Just link all your satellites, have them all transmit to a teacher's type of satellite that's located in one spot. But no, I don't know, Dick. Everybody's got their own satellites, their own receiving stations, all around the globe. You know, they're all over everywhere. Germany, they all have their own big antennas looking up at the sky. Japan, China, what are you gonna do? And then on top of that, you got polar launches, so you got to cover those as well. Just need a whole lot everywhere, Dick.
Do you, JL? Yeah, Tony, recognize. The original question, though, Paul, is I'm not looking at all the satellites. I'm only looking at the satellites in synchronous orbit, the ones that are directly over the equator. Assume you got one satellite every 1 degree all the way around the equator. So you got 360 of them. And where are you going to locate the WS2N ground station so it sees the most number of satellites from that location? Good common sense would lead you to believe, well, you put it up at the North Pole, and now it sees all 360. Not true. North Pole is over the hill, so to speak. You don't see any of them from there. Unless you put it on a tower that's 1,000 miles high, so to speak. I don't know the exact number, but it's a ridiculous altitude. The funniness about that particular puzzle is that you put your ground station directly on the equator. You're only going to see half the satellites, but at least you'll see half of them. As you go further and further north or south of the equator, because of the way the Earth curvature works, you see less and less of those satellites. And up at the North Pole, once you get a little bit beyond the Arctic Circle, you don't see any of them. Over to you, Tony. Tony, KC2 UJL, K2LIW.
Nick, I want to say something. It's a little off the side of the frequency here. The amount of knowledge that's on this station on Sunday night makes the Encyclopedia Britannica look like a comic book. That's one thing. The second thing, I hear that John and all these guys have got laboratories, and if they're not putting their experiments on YouTube so we can see some of the stuff that they're doing, well, shame on them. Nick, I haven't spoken to you in a long time, and I've listened to all of these men. God bless them all, because they really bring the feeling of being a ham radio operator back to where it should be. I just want to put that emphasis on the repeater. Back to you, Dick.
Now, thank you, Tony. That's a very nice compliment. Oh, there's a problem, though. Tony is biased. There's something called the Campanelli Defense Fund. We send him money from time to time. And so he's given us a very good testimony. The check's in the mail, Tony. That's a joke. But I thank you for the compliment. Yeah, the whole idea of the TechNet is that mankind makes the most amount of progress when you display curiosity. So I'd like to believe all of the true ham radio operators, the curious people, gather here. That's what I'd like to believe. In theory, these guys are a little bit more than that derogatory term, appliance operators, people who just buy a rig, plug it in, and start talking. These guys, in many cases, really build. When you go to QRZ.com and you look up KC2WGB, that's John, and you look at the pictures of the stuff that's in his laboratory, I mean, he fell in soft in that he was in the right spot at the right time. Let me drop it. He was in the right spot at the right time, where quite a bit of that material became available to him at a price that he could afford. So, boy, does he have test equipment. Very few ham shacks look anything like that. In fact, I think he's got something like a 2-car garage, and I think the whole garage and maybe another space part of it There's two separate laboratories side by side to contain all that material. Am I approximately right? I haven't visited his facility yet, but one of these days I've got to do that. But I think you've got two separate laboratories side by side in the same building that's larger than a two-car garage. Isn't that true, John? KC2WGB, K2RAW of the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, it is a two-car garage. Half of it is the lab proper that you see in the photographs. The other half is the ham shack and additional laboratory stuff and my drawing tables and digitizers and plotters and stuff like that. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff here, but I have a lot of fun.
Also, there's a certain kind of personality, Tony, that is born with transistors and tubes in his mouth, so to speak. John and I are the exact same age, so for 40 some odd years, maybe is it 50 years, let me think, 56, yeah. 56 to 2006 is 50. Wow. 54 and 5. I've been a ham for 59 years. So, and John comes pretty close to that. So when you get people who are interested in that particular subject, electronics, for all of those years, and they work in that industry, they gather a lot of information. It doesn't mean they got a super high IQ. You're just hearing the result of a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of concentration on one class of subjects, radio communication, over a whole lot of years. So that's what this TechNet gathers, those kind of people. There's one ham per 500 in the general population. The kinds of people who gather at the TechNet, I think there's only one of them per 100 hams. And I could give you some specific results of particular clubs that have a lot of ham radio operators and how many of them are microwave experimenter, so to speak. There's one serious microwave experimenter per roughly 500 hams. So we're getting down to small numbers of the general population. And when they gather in one spot, you get the false impression that hams are really super intelligent people.
Well,
some of them are. Let's see, Paul, I bet you've been in ham radio for darn close to 50 years. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
No, I came in the 80s. So, I came in late. I was probably in my 30s when probably 35 years old at that age. But as far as the space program, that's different. I've been following that since before they were launching people, when they were launching all the animals. Russia was launching the Laika, the dog, and we were launching the Ham, the chimp. Right, that qualifies. Remember we launched a chimp named Ham? Back to you, Dick.
Dick, I think Wesley had a question. I believe he signed in for one.
Okay. N2XJN, K2RIW. You got the floor, Wes. 60 feet ahead. Hey, you're supposed to have signed out. Hal, what do you want to tell us? By the way, how many years have you been in ham radio, Hal?
Okay. So hollow me,
Dick, and you never seen my lab.
The Seven Sisters? I've seen the pictures of the Seven Sisters. And yes, yours is considerably larger than John's, and they're slightly different. But they each have their specialties. Go ahead, Wes. Oh, by the way, Hal had his comment about how much equipment he's got. N2XJN, K2RIW, you got it, Wes?
Yeah, actually, Hal got a lot of stuff. Mostly not equipment, mostly ham radio operating stuff, but he's got a humongous place. Hal.
Yeah, I've seen photographs of it. I've also seen, I've actually sat in his bird, so, I've had a slightly different show than you. You said you had a question earlier, Wes. Go ahead.
I came up with the questions just because there was not many people signing into the TechNet, so I said, okay, we have to wrap it up earlier. Let me just have some stuff that I'm interested with. Propagation of electromagnetic radiation in space. electromagnetic radiation can travel through the vacuum, so object in space of any temperature above the near absolute zero. Question, do you know what is the absolute zero?
0 degrees Kelvin, minus 273.15 degrees centigrade. It has a definition, if that's what you're asking. And by man-made refrigeration procedures, cryogenic procedures, you could get to a temperature that's colder than any other place in space. And a certain kinds of superconductivity and Bose-Einstein state, all kinds of fancy things happen when you get down to super low temperatures. And so when you've got a substance in a container, you've got a thermometer sticking in that container. And now you do something to make that thermometer go to a lower number. What have you done to the stuff in the chamber? Don't tell me you've made it colder. Don't tell me you've taken away some of the heat. What have you done to the material in the container to make the thermometer go to a lower number? In 2XJN, K2RIW.
You've got it right to the core. That's what I'm driving to. So before that, I'm giving just a short question, rather to get into the subject. What is the temperature of space, though?
The average temperature of space is what the Penzias and Wilson experiment did in 1967 at Bell Laboratories with that Hoghorn antenna. And I've sat inside of that antenna one time. I was at the Homedale Laboratory. They found out the background temperature of space of 2.73 degrees. 2.715, I think it is, at a fraction. So the average temperature of space, the residual of the Big Bang, 13.7 billion years later. Big Bang was a very hot fireball. It's been cooling off for 13 billion years. It has now cooled off to 2.715 degrees. So that is the background temperature of space, and that's what your COBE experiment and your the cosmic background radiation is at that temperature. And the Wilkinson anisotropy probe measured that temperature, and now we're measuring the microkelvins of difference between certain spots in order to look at the signature of the Big Bang. Over to you, OS K2RIW.
Yeah, Dick, you are amazing. No wonder why the crowd loves you so much. The temperature of the ideal monatomic gas is the measure of the average kinetic energy of its atom. A question would be, now if I remove all of the particles from the box, then what would be the temperature?
Believe it or not, it's got a temperature. It's got a definition, Wes. Because everything above absolute zero is emitting black body radiation. You can't stop it from doing that. Everything has an absorptivity, A over E index, absorptivity to emissivity ratio. And so I'm looking up something right now. See if I can find it. So the walls of your box are emitting black body radiation. And therefore, even if you've got a perfect vacuum in the box has a definable temperature. You can put a thermometer in that perfect vacuum of your box, and you come up with a temperature, and it will be the temperature of the walls of the box, which are emitting black body radiation into that box. N2XJN, K2RIW.
You're actually completely right and completely 100% wrong. Depends from the conditions. You are right that the temperature in the box will be the temperature of the walls. You are wrong because actually if you remove all of your particles from the box, the temperature of that space is zero. I wonder why would you oppose to me saying it's zero?
Well, okay, They're saying the walls have a temperature. Tell me what the word temperature of the walls mean. What is happening to the wall that gives it a temperature? Over to you, Wes.
I believe John wanted to add something.
Go ahead, John.
I think it's wrong because radiation is what happens. That's where your temperature is going to raise that thermometer. Radiation level, not conduction, not convection, radiation.
Correct. Dick?
Okay. The walls of the box have a temperature. Even though the box has a perfect vacuum, you put a thermometer in that, in the middle of that box, you will measure the temperature of the walls even though you're not in contact with them. If the walls has a particular temperature, what's happening to the walls to give them that temperature, Wes? In 2XJN, K2RAW?
Here's the condition. If you put the thermometer inside the box, you will measure the temperature. The temperature most likely will be 2.7 Kelvin. If you don't put the thermometer in the box, the temperature will be zero. Enter here.
Okay. If that box is located at the N2XJN laboratory in Queens, and it's sitting on the table, and inside the box is a perfect vacuum with an ideal thermometer, tell me what temperature that thermometer will register. Over to you, Wes.
It will register the temperature of the walls. But if you don't put the thermometer, you will have a temperature zero. Enter XGN.
Okay. By what means did the temperature of the walls of the box get conducted to your thermometer? The thermometer is going to measure the temperature of the walls, even though there is no contact with the walls. There is no conduction. There is no convection. Yet the thermometer is going to come to the temperature of the walls. How did the thermometer do that?
Thermometer will not do that. The same like the double slit experiment. You watch it. Behaves different. You don't watch it. It behaves different. You got to understand the nature of the photon. If you look at the empty space, and this is our box, and it says it's empty space. You have no idea that the photon is there. There are plenty of photons there, but you have no idea, and you have no way to find out. The photon is only able to release its energy when it strikes something. When it's cruising through the empty space, there is no exchange of kinetic energy. So, therefore, the theoretical thermometer cannot measure any temperature. The temperature is zero, especially in the given moment, in a given place, where you have a complete emptiness. But once you put the thermometer there, the temperature will be likely 2.7 Kelvin. Enter Aegean.
I got a question.
That's not what NASA does, Wes. When they go to the Goddard Space Flight Center, where they've got the world's largest vacuum chamber that simulates space, and they put their spacecraft in that chamber, they evacuate as much air as they possibly can. They make the most perfect vacuum they can in that chamber. They pass fluids through the walls of the chamber to act like the temperature of the space where that spacecraft is going to go. In some cases, they simulate the sun exposure on one side by turning on lamps, but the walls of the chamber in Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, will conduct that temperature by radiation into that satellite. Now here's the example I'm going to prove that with you. Assume that the north wall of your chamber is thoroughly insulated from the rest of the box, and the south wall is insulated from the rest of the box. And I now start, and I've got perfect vacuum in the box, and I heat up the south wall. Tell me whether or not the insulated north wall will eventually become the same temperature as the south wall, yes or no. And 2XJN, K2RAW.
You left me. Because if you have a south wall, wall, and then you hit the south wall, the photon from the south wall may travel to the north wall. Therefore, the temperature no particles. There would be no exchange of kinetic energy. Therefore, with the time factor, the temperature of the south will be almost close to the temperature of the north. But the temperature inside the box will be zero, because there is no exchange of the kinetic energy into Exia.
Okay, you just negated what you said. You said two statements that conflict. The north wall of the box is insulated from the rest of the box, and the south wall is insulated from the rest of the box. And I heat up the south wall. You did admit that the north wall will eventually gain that temperature of the south wall. Photons of radiated energy are flowing from the south wall through the vacuum to the north wall. That flow of those photons define the temperature of that space. Just like when Penzias and Wilson made their experiment and they aimed their antenna at what you and I call cold sky. They measured the temperature of the cold sky, even though there was nothing but perfect vacuum in that space between that measurement and the rest of that universe. They measured the temperature of the universe through that vacuum. Whatever the temperature of the universe was, which is the wall in their case, that's what their thermometer, which is called radiometer, measured. When the photons flow, I can define that as the temperature, even though there were no free particles that used to be there before your vacuum. N2XJN, K2RIW.
We need time to explain it to you. You have a box. The box has certain size. We may say that space is the box and has a certain size. You have a concentration of the particles in that box. In certain areas it's zero, in certain areas it's not. Let me show.
This is an academic experiment because you can never get a perfect vacuum. There's always a few molecules in that box, and they will be the same temperature as the walls. Therefore, the thermometer in the box, whether the thermometer is there or not, is up to the temperature of the walls of the box of U.S.
No, if we say about the density of the photons, and we take the probability of the photon strike, the amount of particles in given space, we may find that that would be a point at which a thermoid will not be hit by the photon and will show zero. So what I was trying to tell you is, if you have the south wall and the north wall, then south wall is heated, or north wall is heated, the south wall with the time will heat to reach the temperature that is close to the north wall. But in the middle of that box, there has a perfect no particles temperature. You're going to have exchange of the kinetic energy. In other words, if you assume that you have a place at which the...
Tony, you can ask your question now, Tony. KC2UJL, K2RIW, go ahead. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Tony. A flea is easy to measure its weight and its temperature with modern-day equipment. I could measure the temperature of that flea without even touching him. Simply aim a thermal imaging camera, a camera that looks at infrared. That temperature will show up as a certain amount of brightness on that thermal imaging camera. That's exactly what I did with some of the microelectronics I was working on. I aimed a thermal imaging camera at a very compact printed circuit board that held a whole lot of tiny parts on it. I could measure the temperature in each one of those parts by looking at the brightness of that picture on the thermal imaging camera. A thermal imaging camera with a good lens can easily resolve something that's a 10,000th of an inch square. 10,000th of an inch left and right and up and down. A good thermal imaging camera can do that. So I could measure the temperature of an object that's only 1/10,000th of an inch wide and high by looking at how bright it is on that picture. Believe it or not, that sounds pretty fantastic, but those thermal imaging cameras have been around for quite a few decades, Tony. KC2UJL, K2LIW. Yep, that's again another example of radiometry. Looking at the radio emission that comes from something that's warmer than the surrounding. Okay, you guys have listened to technet number 1514, I think it is. Yeah, 1544. We'll be back next week. And 73, you all be kind to each other. Wes and I have got a bit of a disagreement now as to what's the temperature inside of a box with a vacuum. And it's a little bit academic because you can never get a perfect vacuum. There'll always be some molecules in there. And those molecules will have a temperature. And the photons flowing through the box are, in my opinion, giving it a temperature because the photons that flowed through the vacuum of space into Mr. Penzias and Wilson's antenna allowed them to measure the temperature of space, even though in between there was perfect vacuum. You could say they put a thermometer inside a vacuum, and they measured the temperature. So, 73, you all. John, KC2WGB, if you want to say any closing comments, you got it, John. Looking forward to talking to you next week. KC2WGB and the group, K2RIW, clear but listening. Be kind to each other. That's a tough way to go, Tony. Bye-bye, John. Tony, that's the wrong instrument. There are other instruments to make that measurement. You gotta use the right tool depending on what you're trying to do. If you're gonna shoot an elephant, it's gotta be an elephant gun. Bye-bye, Tony, and all. K2RIW clear. See you guys next week.
RIWKC2SHL. On my note, just an idea, though, I didn't look them back. K2RIW, by the call sign, right? 2SHL. Not sure what's going on there, but hopefully I've got it. And I'm keying, but this is KC2SHO, Don down in Mount Laurel, talking to you guys on a IRLP note. Is there anybody from Leemark there who would be able to answer a question about the IRLP setup? KC2SHO, looking for anyone who might have information on who's responsible for the IRLP setup there for Leemark.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Not that bad. I thought it was going to be worse than this, but
It's supposed to get worse on the way home. Gary?
Good morning, John. And I'll let you know when I wake up. Meantime, temperature gauge on the car is reading a balmy 33 degrees. I think that's supposed to be the high for the day, though. We're supposed to drop temperature again?
Oh, yeah. That's what I heard. And I'm glad some of this stuff has dried up a little bit, because I thought it was going to be all ice. You know, it's going to be like a lousy commute. But, alright. There certainly is a lot more traffic. It's all those teachers are back, you know. just coming into, just going over, I should say, the Clearview Expressway.
Alright, you gotta jump on me. I'm just getting onto the Meadowbrook now. So far, the traffic is very light. But I'm not near the city yet.
Yeah, it stays that way. I'm, it was, you know, no incidents, no nothing. It's going in. A good pace, I should say. Oh, yeah. Anyway, I feel the same way this morning. I don't think I ever woke up. When I woke up this morning, I was like, what happened? Why am I so tired? But maybe because I went to bed late, maybe that's why.
I just hope I don't have to do any more shoveling. Yesterday was lots of fun. All that wet, heavy stuff. And I also end up having to dig a drainage trench in the street so that the water would drain from my driveway down to the storm drain.
Yeah, I know. That, they're like, not there a few, couple of times, on and off, and trying to, kind of clear the, you know, it's funny with that, I was surprised to see this big boulder in my driveway, like, what happened? I realized now that these guys plowed, and they cut it closer and closer, so... But, cleared it all up. It's going into the canyon now.
Well, because of where my neighbors park their cars, the plow can never get to the curb, or anywhere near the curb in front of my driveway. So I've got 10 feet of street before I get to plowed street. And the pitch of the land is such that I'm one house off the corner, and the houses, Lakeville Lane is lower in elevation than Merrick Avenue, and my corner is higher than where the storm drain is. So I get water draining down from Merrick Avenue all the way in front of my house, and then it hits my snow dam of 10 feet in my driveway, and my driveway fills up with water. So if I don't create a drainage ditch on a day like yesterday, I got a lake that's a double car driveway wide by 10 feet wide.
Wow. Yeah, we, I don't know. Although sometimes it's a pain, but we get, like there's no parking on a street, like between 2 and 6. And sometimes it's a pain in the neck, but, and they're doing, like, a lot of construction to the house across the street from me, and there's always, like, about 3 or 4 cars parked all around. But, yeah, I saw the plow yesterday going along, dumping sand and whatever. If I can pass this guy out, the Jackie Robinson Park right here. School bus. What are the school buses doing up so early?
mound of snow in the street just to one side of my driveway. A little bit of a road hazard. I knocked it down. I had to use a pickaxe to get to loosen it up to shovel it.
You know, this guys, it was a little bit warmer yesterday. Traveling down, my wife goes like, "Oh, look out!" Like, and I'm looking, and I'm going like, "What?" I said, "Don't you see it? Like a little bit ahead of me, though." She saw it like right away. This guy has this long driveway. He pushed all the snow out and mounded it into the street. I mean, mounded it. If a car ran into it, definitely would have gotten damaged. And I was like, "What did?" Oh man, I had some choice words in my mind for that guy. I was like, "That dopey guy, like, puts all that snow, mounds of it, like, it must have been like over the top of the car, the hood of the car." What are you doing? You know, I guess as long as he gets it out of his driveway, I guess.
I try to get as much as I can onto the grass, because there I can just let it melt as it, you know, when and if it will. But the stuff that's in the street, I just push to one side of the driveway or the other. It's already in the street.
Yeah, but this guy had it. I mean, he pushed it all the way out that, well, I went around it, but of course, but it was blocking the whole lane. In other words, like, I slowed down, waited for the car on the opposite side of the street to pass me, and then I went around it. Right, this was like really high. This was too much. Much. And, a lot of puddles. But today the roads are pretty nice, pretty dry. I'm pleasantly surprised at this, because I thought it was going to be that. And that's it. Now, tomorrow I go in later, so I go in much later than now. See how the traffic is then.
Well, tomorrow and Wednesday I have a late commute also. I will be commuting around 12 o'clock in the afternoon.
Nice. Did you ever get your car cleaned? You said you were going to get the guy in the garage or whatever.
I'm thinking of letting the weather forecast confirm itself, because I've heard various things about later in this week, but possibly Wednesday I'll give him the 20 and say, "Get it clean."
Yeah. Yeah, my wife's got a good. We bought the Honda, over in Franklin Avenue, Millennium Honda. They have a car wash service. You bring your car as many times as you want, get it cleaned. She went down there, she's got it cleaned. And I looked at my car, it was like black on the side of it. I'm like, wow. they don't allow anybody else. Gary, back to you. This is N2EB.
N2EB, N2ZEB. Yeah, well, believe it or not, the rain Saturday night cleaned a good part of the salt off my car. Hopefully between now and Wednesday, whatever salt is on the road gets kicked around and off, so that if I wash the car on Wednesday, it'll be nice for a weekend. A few days, at least. Until the next snowstorm.
Yep. Okay, Jerry, I'm in the lot. Oh, it looks like it's louder. That's surprising. Anyway.